Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Of Bears and Weight Loss, How to Manage Triggers, Lose Weight, and Enjoy Getting Fit, by Dr. Brian King. Narrated by Steve Marvel. Bonjour de Montreal. I hope that by writing this, I don't accidentally encourage a ton of new people to relocate to Montreal, Quebec. Massive influxes of new citizens can change the feel of a city. I've seen it happen in others that I've lived in and loved. Not that I had anything to do with it, but Austin, Texas became unrecognizable soon after I finished college there. New Orleans, San Francisco, and Portland all saw population booms while I was living within each of their borders, and I watched the cultures of all three change right in front of me. I would hate to have this happen to my beautiful Montreal, and that is certainly not my intention. But as I sit looking out my window onto the historic plaza that doubles as my front yard and attempt to gather my thoughts and notes for this book, all I keep returning to is how great it is to be here. I first came to Montreal after my last year of college. I was working as a counselor at a summer camp about 2 hours upstate from New York City. It was the kind of job that college students take more for the experiences than the money. As I traveled all the way to New York from my college in Texas for camp counselor wages, clearly I was in it for those experiences. About every 2 weeks, the campers would go home, and the staff members would have a few days off to do as we pleased. Some chose to stay at the camp, enjoying quiet time in nature, but most of us headed down to New York City to do all the things that people do there. One break, however, I decided to point my car north. Another counselor was a student at McGill University in Montreal, and after telling him I had never been there, he offered me a chance to stay at his apartment, which otherwise was going to be empty all summer. My brother John, who also worked at the camp that year, decided to join me, as did two of our friends from New York, and we spent a long weekend exploring this amazing French-speaking city to the north. I felt as if we had flown across the Atlantic, when all it really took was a few hours in the car. Even though we didn't speak French, my friends and I managed to get by, finding ourselves bar-hopping, sightseeing, and perpetually smiling for the entire weekend. I absolutely loved it, and always expressed a desire to return. However, life got in the way, as it tends to do. I finished college in Austin, graduate school in New Orleans and Ohio, and started working in Pennsylvania before moving to California, Oregon, and back to California. A full 20 years passed before I made it back to Montreal, driving over after a tour of the New England states. A little bit older and slightly more sober, I was reminded of how beautiful the city is. I spent most of my time in Old Montreal, eating and drinking Bloody Caesars, and promised myself not to let another 20 years pass before my next visit. 2 years later, I made good on that promise, this time with my new girlfriend Sarah, along for the ride. We stayed for a month, and with the extra time, we discovered Montreal's festival season. Our favorites were the Mural Festival, which annually transforms buildings around town into works of art, the Montreal Jazz Festival, which offers amazing concerts every night for free, the Cirque Festival, which we stumbled onto after witnessing a circus performer flash mob, and of course the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. In between, we explored city parks and museums and had so much fun that by the time we left, one of us was pregnant. I'll let you guess which one. We came back the following year, this time with our barely 3-month-old daughter, Alyssa, and spent about 2 months in a neighborhood called Le Plateau Mont-Royal. For the few years before that summer, I had been thinking of putting down some roots somewhere, but I hadn't yet found a place that felt right. Now that I had a family, establishing roots was on my mind more than ever. I had never before considered buying a home outside of my country of birth, especially not my first home, but that city reaffirmed our love for a city full of art and culture and for each other. We wanted to own a piece of it and be a part of it. some very effective signs around the neighborhood and curiosity led us to pop into a local real estate office on a goof. I can only imagine how we appeared when we walked in, an English-speaking American couple pushing a stroller, but the agent took the time to show us some properties anyway, and he guided us through the French-Canadian real estate process. By the time we left town, we owned a small condo in a wonderful neighborhood. It would be years before we had an opportunity to use it, which is ironic, as our initial intent was to drop some roots, but that is where I am now. Last month, after spending a few years away from Montreal, my family drove halfway across the United States and returned to the city and condo we'd fallen in love with for the purpose of my writing this book on weight management. And yes, it is great to be here, although, after having indulged in a few poutines, I am starting to question that decision. 1. Three books. Who am I, anyway? You can probably tell from what I've written so far that I've moved around a lot, and in more than one way. I've changed careers almost as often as I've changed zip codes. One time, while on stage, I asked a man in the audience what he did for a living, and he told me he was a limousine driver. So I asked him how he got into that, and he said, "Believe it or not, I used to drive a taxi." Do you need the phrase, "believe it or not," in this situation? I think that's a pretty obvious career path. I would have also accepted bus driver. Save the phrase, "believe it or not," for when you have something truly unbelievable to tell me, like, "believe it or not, I used to be a wet nurse." Believe it or not, I am just a typical psychologist turned comedian turned public speaker turned author turned wet nurse. That actually sounds like a ridiculous career path when I lay it all out in a single sentence, and it would even if I cut out the one that isn't true, but living it felt a lot more organic. I was the first person on both sides of my family to go to college. My parents had suggested I go to trade school or follow in the family tradition and join the military, but being the rebellious kid I was, I decided to enroll at the University of Texas at Austin. When I started, I had no idea what kind of career I wanted to pursue, and that may help explain my path a bit. I wanted to be an artist, writer, and comedian, but I knew those roads would be difficult to follow and didn't require advanced education, so I took classes in whatever interesting subjects fit my schedule until it was time to pick a major. I settled on psychology because I had accumulated more credits toward that degree than any other, and I was fortunate to meet and learn from some professors whose work continues to influence me today. I graduated and went on to earn a doctorate, because if I'm going to be the first in my family to do something, I'm going to make damn sure I go the distance. Now armed with several diplomas from prestigious universities, all with the word psychology on them, I've done a lot of different things as a psychologist. I've been a consultant, a professor, and even a therapist. I had to quit that last role because I got really sick of listening to people whine about their problems. Always with the yak, 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 and I'd be thinking, "Shut up. You're not going to do what I'm going to tell you anyway. Give me your money and let's go home." Actually, that's just a joke. I was never a therapist. I never wanted to go that route. However, I did want to make people laugh. I've always wanted to, but I never put any effort into doing so professionally until after I finished my doctorate degree. That was important for me to get first, because I figured I needed a fallback plan in case my dream of being a comedian didn't work out. Most people chase the dream first. I chased my safety net first. It isn't how I'd recommend going about it, but I like how everything worked out eventually. The other reason I waited to start performing stand-up comedy was that I really had no idea how to get into it. As I mentioned, no one in my family had been to college, and certainly no one had attempted a career in entertainment, so I was clueless about how to start. Austin, where I went to college, is a great city for comedy, but I was too busy with schoolwork and other activities to get on stage. Then I went on to graduate school, which selfishly monopolized even more of my free time. Moving a few times in my early career didn't help either, not to mention the near total lack of internet. Did you know that there was a time when you couldn't immediately find the answer to any random thought that popped into your head? You almost had to stumble onto things or forget about them. I was living in San Francisco when I stumbled past a sign on my way home from work that advertised stand-up comedy classes, reminding me of my long-neglected desire to be a comedian. I enrolled in the class as soon as I could, and within a week I was kicking myself for not starting sooner. I was shocked to learn that the barriers of entry for comedy are non-existent. It was the making a living part that would prove to be difficult. This is why whenever anyone asks me what you can do with a degree in psychology, I always answer, comedian. For a few years, I was a solid presence in the San Francisco comedy scene, performing and developing my craft. I even opened up my own comedy club, which allowed me to perform 4 nights a week and get better much faster than I would have if I'd had to rely on short open mic sets. Eventually, being a comedian with a PhD in psychology led to public speaking opportunities, and I started touring the country delivering humorous seminars on happiness and the health benefits of laughter. And then I wrote a book. During a seminar in Los Angeles, a talent agent asked me if I wanted to write one, and hell yes, I did. A couple of weeks later, we were signing a fresh new contract over drinks at the Chateau Marmont on Sunset, because that's where all Hollywood contracts are signed. That book, The Laughing Cure, remains a work that I am incredibly proud of, and unlike a lot of my earlier attempts at writing, rarely makes me cringe when I pick it up. At the risk of spoiling that book for you, one of the primary benefits of humor is that it helps us manage stress. Humor also makes us happy, helps strengthen relationships, and has many physical benefits. However, as much as I loved sharing this message along with a few laughs, I realized that if I could help people learn how to better manage stress, that would really have an impact. The vast majority of all illnesses that we face in the modern world, both mental and physical, have a stress component. Not everything can be laughed off or joked about, and I became increasingly interested in stress management in general. This eventually led to my most recent book, The Art of Taking It Easy, published toward the end of 2019. That book is a work I am truly proud of. When The Art was released, it looked like it was positioned to do really well and take my career in new directions. I got a lot of good press, did a few local TV and radio interviews, and was even asked by the producers of a national talk show to appear. I have written only 2 books at this point, and yet new writers ask me for advice all the time. The best advice I can give? Try not to publish your book just before a global pandemic. The Art came out a couple months prior to one of the most stressful periods of our lives, the COVID-19 pandemic. You may remember, people stopped buying things for a while, like books, except toilet paper. People sure bought a lot of that for some reason. I joked with my publishers that we should have printed on 2-ply. People would have boxes of my books in their closets. Read a page, use a page. Hey, I gotta go to the can. Will you pass me another copy of that book? I still think that is a good idea. All kidding aside, everything was canceled for me. Speaking tours, book signings, and media appearances. I lost my livelihood, and to make matters worse, this great book I had written was going to go relatively unnoticed. Of course, underwhelming book sales were not the worst thing to happen during the pandemic. They weren't even the worst thing to happen to me during the pandemic. But they did hit me hard. When the pandemic came to the United States, Sarah and I had been living on the road without a permanent residence for over 5 years, the last 4 with our daughter. We were a nomadic, vagabond family. We worked on the road and lived as we worked. When the government tells you to shelter at home and you don't have a home, what do you do? Thankfully, we were in a position to go anywhere, and we chose to spend most of our time in Texas. I have always loved Texas, but after finishing college in Austin, I never thought I would move back. For the first time since leaving California, we had a place to call home for more than a few months. Despite everything, I think we all found it to be a refreshing change. About 6 months into the pandemic, something really interesting happened. Maybe people were looking for ways to relieve their stress. Maybe they were bored. Or maybe they had completely run out of toilet paper and were super desperate. But people started buying my book, especially in other countries. It became an international bestseller. Suddenly, I started hearing from readers in places like Germany, hello, Brazil, hola, and Poland. Dzień dobry. It has been amazing and has renewed my interest in being a writer. So after writing books on humor and stress management, why turn my attention to weight management? Well, if you had read those books, you probably can guess. If you haven't, another thing you should probably know about me is that throughout all of the experiences I have shared with you so far, I did everything with an extra person's worth of body weight attached to my frame. If I were on stage or TV right now, I wouldn't have to state the obvious, but since you are listening to this, I'll put it as simply as I can. I am fat. I'm a fat guy, and to paraphrase Janet Jackson, that's Dr. Fat Guy if you're nasty. I'm not as fat as I used to be, thankfully. Over the past few years, I've managed to lose about 100 pounds. I still have a way to go before I get down to my goal weight, but that is badass. I look better, I feel incredible, and I can almost see my penis without a mirror. I hope that by the end of this book, I'll be able to report, without lying to you, that I can see more of it. There must be more of it down there. I may have my work cut out for me, though. As soon as I got settled in Montreal, I hopped on a scale and saw that my recent tour and the road trip here had put about 20 pounds back on. The struggle is real, folks. The struggle is real. The ship that almost passed me in the night. It is perfect timing that I am now at the part where I further introduce Sarah, as just yesterday we celebrated our 7-year anniversary. We share the day with the American Independence Day, which almost completely guarantees I will never forget it. It also guarantees that every year for our special day, there will be fireworks. This time, since we're Americans living in Canada, we grabbed our passports and headed south to Plattsburgh, New York, with our daughter for a nice dinner before the show. I no doubt went way over my desired calorie count, probably setting back my progress even further, but it was an enjoyable, if not wildly debauched, evening, and I have successfully avoided my scale all day. I don't remember meeting the woman whom I now refer to as my wife. For most guys, that might not be something they would want to openly admit, but my situation is a little different. When we met, I was just a few years into my career as a nationally touring public speaker and was giving a seminar on the topic of happiness in Gainesville, Florida, where she was living. At that time, I presented to thousands of people each year and talked to throngs of them every day. Looking back at my tour schedule for that year, I figured out that I had left Tallahassee the day before we met, presented in Gainesville, and traveled on to Tampa shortly after my seminar. My life moved fast then, and that tour was a whirlwind. I started the month in Texas, circled all around Florida, went on a cruise around the Caribbean, and ended up back at my home in Los Angeles. When the dust settled and I had a chance to sit back and take it easy, I went through my social media and reviewed the friend requests I received along the tour. Among them was one from an incredibly beautiful occupational therapist who lived in Gainesville. Her name was Sarah, and I could never have guessed the impact she would ultimately have on my life. At the time, Sarah's profile photo was a side-by-side comparison of images of her before and after losing a substantial amount of weight. I thought she looked incredible in both shots. She had long red hair, which I have always been drawn to, bright eyes, a beautiful smile, and a perfect hourglass figure. I left a comment, "Beautiful before, beautiful after," to which she replied, "Thank you, Brian. I feel so much better, though, now. Much happier, too." As of this writing, that was 8 years ago to the month, and it hardly reads like flirting, let alone the beginning of a long-term relationship. The thing I didn't know about Sarah was that at the time of my seminar, she was thinking she could help me. I think she remembers it best, so I'll let her share her version of that day. Not remembering when we met, Brian often makes up different jokes, depending on the company, about the day we met. There are probably about 7 versions of our story milling around. One is about a cute woman in the back of the conference center getting up and repeatedly walking around, stretching, and trying to draw attention to herself. Apparently, I wasn't quite doing it right, as he didn't remember me later, but ironically enough, that's exactly what I was doing that day. Sitting still has never been my style, and since I'd worked in busy hospitals and clinics for years, sitting still in a classroom-like setting for over 6 hours for a seminar was not my forte, nor in my philosophy, what was best for my health. Between stretching, I would of course return to my seat, and luckily, the seminar was far from boring. As a matter of fact, it was the best seminar I have attended to date. I listened intently, laughed, used what I heard to reflect on my own life, and took notes. Notes not only about the course material, but also general observations about seminar attendees and Dr. Brian King himself, including poison berries, photography, and Luna. More on why those are important later. But one point of contention that stuck out in my mind and in my notes was this nonchalant statement he made: losing weight is easy. Eat less, move more. I kind of audibly and sarcastically chuffed, "Huh," and thought to myself, "It's not that easy." I wrote down and underlined, "Not." Having been through my own weight loss journey, and more than once I might add, and having worked as an occupational therapist and a health coach in lifestyle redesign and weight loss, I knew that it wasn't that easy. Change isn't that easy. Health is multifaceted, and human bodies are complicated and amazing. And then I thought to myself, I'm going to help this guy. He seems like a tough nut to crack, but tenaciously, I'm going to do it somehow. Toward the end of the seminar, I walked in a polka dot dress up to Brian, smiled, gave him my business card, which also included the before and after pic, asked a question about the course material, thanked him for the presentation, and the rest, as they say, is history. Well, sort of. There would be a lot of interaction points and ships passing in the night moments. What is it they say? It takes something like 5 interactions before a person remembers you. At some point, I started to notice Sarah on social media and began paying attention. We got to know each other a little through snarky comments, jokes, and the occasional interaction, and we even almost met up in San Francisco about a year after we first met, though that didn't work out, prompting Sarah to describe us as ships passing in the night, a phrase I never really cared for. Then I had another seminar tour take me through Gainesville and was hoping to connect, but unfortunately, Sarah was unable to attend. We finally met up socially about a year and a half after first following each other online at a cafe in Tampa where she was temporarily working. I may not remember our first encounter, but trust me, I have a very vivid recollection of the second time we met. Sarah and I share a mutual love of Cuban food, actually most foods now that I think about it, and she suggested a nice casual spot called La Terracita. She arrived before me and ordered a drink. There was counter service as well as dining tables, and as I entered, I saw her now familiar, perfectly shaped hourglass figure perched on a stool at the counter. I think I fell in love in that moment, and I walked over to be as funny and charming as I could be so that she would do the same. It must have worked, because 2 days later, she drove up to Gainesville to surprise me at a comedy show I was performing in. Shortly after, I returned to Los Angeles, and she took a contract in Boulder, Colorado. But in the months that followed, we were in touch more than ever, growing closer and closer despite the distance. By June, I had made plans for a road trip to visit her in Colorado for the 4th of July, for what we now refer to as our first date. Looking back, I wonder how many members of my audience had similar thoughts about helping me. That year, as I traveled the country, I was carrying around about 140 extra pounds of baggage strapped to the outside of my skeleton. It was like I was smuggling an extra person under my clothes to accompany me through life. And for what? So it could make my airplane seat seem smaller and prevent me from getting laid? When I was in college, I once got arrested in New York City when a buddy and I attempted to squeeze through a subway turnstile two at a time, but at least then we were trying to save a subway token by pretending to be a single dude. I had nothing to gain by lugging this stowaway on my body everywhere I went, yet there we were, flaunting our combined girth in front of audiences day after day, stuffed into an ever-tightening suit. I didn't look terrible, but my appearance was made ironic by the fact that my seminars then were all about how to change behavior and live a healthier life. I was a walking example of poor lifestyle choices, and I was telling people like Sarah how they could be healthier. I may have inspired similar thoughts in others, but only Sarah chose to follow through and actually help improve my life. She had her work cut out for her, too. She had to first convince me to pursue her halfway across the country, fall crazily in love with her, and have a child together. I don't work in healthcare, but that seems way beyond the usual call of duty for an occupational therapist. Fat Tales, Bringing Sexy Back. I love Florida. On tour there, sometime after my first encounter with Sarah, I did something so super cool and funny that the story made it into my stand-up act. I went swimming with manatees. If you don't know, manatees are large, docile aquatic mammals. I am sure you know what they are, but to make sure we are all on the same page, they are these giant-ass animals that weigh about 1,000 pounds each and have tiny little eyes. They are the cutest, massive beasts you will ever encounter while exploring an environment clearly not intended for humans. Manatees are a protected species, but there is one place in Florida, the Crystal River, where you are allowed to swim with them. So, of course, when my tour took me through that part of the country, I absolutely took advantage of the opportunity and booked a trip with one of the local manatee tour companies. Unfortunately, the first thing we were told we had to do was change into wetsuits. Yeah, I'm not interested in putting on a wetsuit, and certainly wasn't back then. But Sean, the tour captain, told me the water was too cold to go swimming without one, so I told him that I would just observe the manatees from the boat. At this point, I wasn't quite on my peak weight yet, but I was still clocking in somewhere above 350, and I assumed they wouldn't have a suit I could squeeze all of that into. I was wrong. I may have worn a 3XL shirt, but apparently 6XL was my wetsuit size. It was the biggest size they had, but once they convinced me they had one that would fit me, I was like, okay, I guess I'm going in the water. Even at 6XL, it was a little snug, so they helped me into it. Well, put it on me, and it was an attractive look. Me in a wetsuit. Do you remember Batman Returns? I seriously looked like Danny DeVito playing the Penguin. Yeah, I was bringing sexy back. Take that, Timberlake. As soon as I was in the water, the manatees started approaching me. Seriously, I was only in the water for a few minutes when 5 or 6 giant manatees came straight up to me. My first response was to think, wow, this is incredible. Then I looked around and noticed that none of the other divers were being approached and thought, wait a minute, in a wetsuit, I kind of look like a manatee. I felt like they were saying, hey, who's the new guy? Welcome to our feeding grounds. It's weird that I had that thought, but I was in the water enjoying myself and floating around when they came over. If there is one thing I do well in water, it's float. I remember swimming lessons as a chubby kid when I struggled to learn the breaststroke, but the instructors told my parents, he floats like a log. You'll understand why, then, when the guy on the boat asked if I wanted an additional floaty, I said, no, I'm good. It's not like this body is going to sink. Manatees are really neat creatures, and it's pretty cool when they come right up to you in the wild. They don't have any biting teeth, just ones for grinding, so they aren't very threatening. That doesn't stop them from trying to bite, though. They call it a manatee kiss, but I don't think they were trying to make out with me. Well, maybe one did hump my leg. But seriously, being in the water with them was a magical experience that I would recommend for anyone, size 6XL and
Sample complete. Ready to continue?